Well, first of all, thank you all for coming tonight. We really appreciate it. It's great to see you all. And the assignment will be after the lecture, I guess. This does remind you of college a little bit, doesn't it?
It does.
Political science class.
I used to fall asleep in these things.
Can everybody hear us okay?
Hello. No. How's that? Better?
How about this? Better? There we go.
Better, better.
Turning the mics on helps. So, you know, it's interesting. I don't know how many of you listen to my show. There you go. Nice. Good answer. Dawn Stensland actually is in the back. Somebody asked. They always do, but she's in the back. We talk about Trump, obviously, a lot. He's an incredible phenomenon. And a lot of people have questions in terms of the magic of Trump. So I wanted to figure it out. You know, I really wanted to get to the bottom of who Trump is. And we thought about it. We said, well, we could have Trump in himself, but that's boring. Let's go.
I'm not sure about that.
He never says anything that's controversial at all. So let's go to a man who has literally had Trump's ear, who is now nationally known on CNN, but who's right here in Pennsylvania in our backyard. So that's why it's so great to have Jeff Lord with us tonight. So, Jeff, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's good to be in King of Prussia. Does anybody here, I mean, he passed away the other day, know Drew Lewis or remember Drew Lewis? From Montgomery County. Drew Lewis was my boss in the Reagan campaign. I was his chief of staff after he fired the air traffic controllers and went back into private business. He was involved with the Reagan reelection campaign, and I was his chief of staff. And so it was just very sad, but I, you know, certainly am very familiar with King of Prussia, so it's good to be here.
Now let's talk about President Reagan. You were the White House political director.
One of them, right, exactly.
Yeah. So that sounds like a pretty cool title, if you ask me.
Well, Nancy and I. it was tremendous experience. I was there in the second term. He was outstanding to work for. He was, interestingly, a very humble guy, firm convictions. I compare him to Donald Trump in some ways. I mean, no two human souls are alike, and Donald Trump is not Ronald Reagan. They do have some similarities. Reagan was the kind to give you one anecdote. In one of his hospital sojourns in the second term, and I forget which one, you know, he had a few illness problems, and he was at Bethesda Naval, and he was in the bathroom by himself, and a glass of water fell on the floor. I guess it was a plastic cup. So the water's all over the floor. So there was nobody in there at that exact second. And in comes the nurse, and there he is on his hands and knees cleaning this up. And she says, Mr. President, what are you doing? Well, you know, you should let me do this. And he says, well, you know, I didn't want you to get in trouble. So I thought I made the mess. I would clean it up. And that is the kind of guy. He was very, very human, very, very, yeah, you know, terrific.
What was he like to work for in terms of how did he treat you as one of his guys?
Yeah, he was great. I mean, I was young, of course. I had a mustache, and you know, when he was very. Remember, his profession had been as an actor, so he, if you will, took direction. Well, he looked for it. I mean, he wanted, you know, his job was to show up and talk, and he knew what to talk about. But, you know, if you said, Mr. President, you come in here and you stand here, well, okay. Yeah. You know, he was fine. He would know exactly what to do. He was very principled, though, and, you know, the legion of stories, I mean, one of the ones that I remember, the famous tear this wall to Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. The bureaucracy, as you can imagine, in the State Department was apoplectic, and at the notion that this would be in one of his speeches in Berlin. And the way this works in the White House staffing system is that you get these speeches sent around to people like me and all kinds of people, and you read the speech and you write your comment, and it goes back and forth and back and forth. And the striped pants set, as it were, was just aghast that he would say this. And they kept taking it out. Well, this goes back and forth, and he flies across to Germany, and he gets there, and he's in the car, and they've taken it out, you know, sending these speeches, repeated copies, and it's out. And finally, he takes a pen and writes it back in, and he turns to his chief of staff, who was somebody that I knew from college, as it turned out, and says, they want me to take this out. What should I do? And Ken Duberstein looks at him and says, Mr. President, you're the president. And he says, well, the boys will be unhappy with me, but I'm going to say it. But it was that, I mean, that, in that small moment, you get a sense of how overwhelming the Washington establishment bureaucracy can be for whomever sits in that chair. And they're always at you, trying to move you. If you're here, they want you to move here, mm-hmm. or here, or they want to move you anywhere than other than where you know, you've come out and said to the American people, I will be here.
Right.
And so there's this constant ongoing battle for whoever sits in that office. And this goes on to a lesser extent with senators and congressmen as well. But Ronald Reagan was very, very good about this. One other quick story is that early in the administration, someone, and I keep thinking this was Al Haig, who was then Secretary of State, came in, and it was an issue about signing off on a treaty, the law of the sea treaty, some international treaty. And there was all this kind of pressure. And Haig or whomever it was made the mistake of saying, well, Mr. President, it's always been done this way. To which Reagan replied, well, Al, isn't that why we're here? And that's exactly what you want, is somebody who is going to say to these people, no, we're not going to do this anymore. We're going to do this in another way altogether.
So I imagine there's a lot of parallels to that with Donald Trump. But before I get to there, American Spectator. Does anybody read American Spectator? I love it. It's a great site. It's you know, one of the finer conservative publications. And I would argue now that National Review has gone the way they have.
Ah, the Trump fans.
Probably more people are going to be reading the American Spectator. But so how'd you get involved with them?
I had decided to set out and become a writer. Of course, people said to me, what are you doing? And so I just sat down and wrote and wrote and wrote. And, you know, I wrote all the novels that didn't get published. And, you know, I think there's 6 or 7 of them. Now suddenly there's interest. Well, this is good. But I finally thought, you know, you should start writing political things because, of course, I'd been involved in this. And so I got published, one in National Review Online, as a matter of fact, and then one in the Wall Street Journal. And somebody suggested, well, you know, you should send it to the American Spectator. And I'd actually done that when I first started on my writing career and got sort of a poignant story. I got a letter in those days that you'd get a rejection or acceptance letter in the mail, and I got this very nice note from Sandy Hume, who was involved with the magazine at that time. And Sandy Hume, if you're not familiar with him, is the son of was the son of Britt Hume, and later, sadly, he committed suicide. I don't know all the ins and outs of it, but one of the tragedies in Britt Hume's life. But at that point, I got this very nice letter that said thanks, but no thanks. And of course, being somewhat persistent, I just kept it up. And finally, on one occasion, something caught their eye. And they said, can you do this again? And I said, well, sure. And then, can you do it again? Can you keep doing this? And so now I do 2 columns a week for the American Spectator. I do 3 columns a week for Conservative Review, which is new. And I do 1 sort of media-related column on weekends for Newsbusters, which is Brent Bozell's Media Research Center, where conservatives keep an eye on the media, on people like me on CNN.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting, right, because Conservative Review has not been particularly friendly to Donald Trump.
National Review.
Conservative Review has.
But Brent Bozell, they've been back and forth. They have Cruz fans and other fans. Right. But
Brent Bozell has clearly been against Donald Trump, and he still lets you work there.
He's still good.
All right,
Brent has an open mind.
So CNN, it's a great story, too, of how Jeffrey got hooked up with CNN. It's really cool because we're sitting back there. We're talking before we came out here tonight. And, you know, and I'm wondering, how does a guy from Harrisburg wind up becoming a CNN contributor? And, you know, we all know media bias is real, right? We all agree with that? Yeah. So Donald Trump certainly agrees with that. This is one of the reasons I think he's doing so well, is because he calls out media bias everywhere it is. So the reason why Jeffrey's on CNN has a lot to do with Donald Trump calling out media bias.
So the story is, at least as I understand it, Donald Trump, shortly after he announces in the middle of June, is sitting down with a reporter from MSNBC, a woman whose name escapes me. And somewhere in there she says, there are people in the conservative media who don't like you, Mr. Trump. And she names, I think, Charles Krauthammer and Jonah Goldberg. And Donald Trump says something totally Trumpian, like, Jonah Goldberg has no pants. He says, but you're not going to mention the people who do like me, are you? Well, she doesn't. And so the interview goes on and ends. Later in the day, he sits down with Anderson Cooper from CNN. And they're there in Trump Tower, and they do this interview for about 40 minutes. And that subject didn't come up. Afterwards, though, he says to Anderson and whoever is with him, you know, you guys at CNN, you always have me on, and then you follow me up with these Bush guys who hate me. And why don't you put somebody on there that likes me? And they said, who? And he says, call Jeffrey Lord. Now, Jeffrey Lord is totally unaware of all of this. Sitting there in Harrisburg, suburban Harrisburg, typing my columns, and suddenly the phone rings from CNN. And they want me to go on, you know, a radio interview, you know, a call-in interview. And I do it, and I hang up, and I think, well, that's odd. And then it rings again, and then it rings again. By the end of the day, I'd been on CNN four times, once or twice on the phone, once on Skype, and then I had to go over to the local television PBS studio and satellite in. And I should say by now the story is out there. I came home to take care of my parents. My dad's passed away, but my mom is 96. So, you know, I'm writing and working, and that's so I just can't leave her, right? So I quickly call somebody from our church, can you come over here and sit? Well, so this goes on for like 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And I come home from the studio one night, and there's an email from CNN that says, please call us, contract. So, to my amazement, I guess they found out I don't drool on television. They wanted me because I, interestingly, not just because I worked for Ronald Reagan and supported Donald Trump, but because I lived in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania, which is to say I did not live in New York City and I didn't live any longer in Washington, D.C. And the very first time I was at CNN in New York, having started, I was in the green room with the president of CNN, and I think it was Fareed Zakaria, and we were watching Marco Rubio on one of the monitors, and I forget what he said. But at any rate, there was immediate disagreement with Senator Rubio. And I said, well, you know, he's right about whatever, you know, and in the people I talk to, meaning the people in the church and the grocery store and the normal life in Central Pennsylvania, can you believe that, all you Eastern Pennsylvania people? So I said, they think whatever. And the president of CNN turns around and says, and that is exactly why we hired you. So it's been terrific. There I am with Anderson Cooper, and who's just terrific. These people have been wonderful to me, very fair. I get to debate. As Jeff Zucker, the CNN president, says to me, have we censored you ever? No. Do we let you say what you want? Yes, absolutely. So I go at it with my new friends in life, David Axelrod from Obama fame, and Van Jones from Obama fame, and Paul Begala from Clinton fame, and I'm the Reagan guy, the Reagan-Trump guy, and we have a good time doing it.
There's other people with you as well, right? There was bald guy who said he was wrong, and you were so right.
Michael somebody.
I don't
Michael
know. It doesn't matter.
Smirk,
anyway,
smirk,
it doesn't, it's really not.
A complicated
it really,
name,
it
I don't.
It doesn't, you know, I mean.
Right, right.
We're all bad with names these
yeah,
days.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we love seeing you on there. You really do a great job. And one of the things that I think is really interesting about CNN is that they have been very fair to Donald Trump. Don Lemon, for example, has been very fair to Donald Trump. Anderson Cooper. By the way, I thought Anderson did a tremendous job with those town hall meetings.
Yes.
They were great. It was so much better than the debates because you could actually hear these guys talk, and they were really a nice change of pace. All right, so how many of you are committed Donald Trump supporters in the room? Raise your hand. You crazy bastards, you. No.
And you have no idea how many times I get the question from incredulous people, do you really think Donald Trump could carry Pennsylvania? And I say, yes, I do.
Now, how many of you are leaning towards Donald Trump? Okay.
Amazing.
How many of you are not supporting Donald Trump? Come, never, not even,
come
no on, way.
Come sit right up here.
You know, one of the things that I've observed about this, Jeff, is I think Donald Trump supporters are some of the most passionate people I've ever met in my years in politics, certainly.
Right. One of the reasons I wrote this book, I just was tired of the notion that Donald Trump supporters are a bunch of, you know, rubes, bigots, racist, and xenophobes. And I mean, hello. We're talking about really good people, hardworking people, Americans who've got, you know, they're concerned about their country and they're doing what you're supposed to do in this country. You're picking your candidate and you're going out and you're showing up and you're doing your deal. As I was saying beyond backstage there in the green room, the other day after a CNN appearance in New York, I came home to Pennsylvania. Sunday afternoon, I'm home for about a half hour. The doorbell rings, and this is suburbia. And I'm thinking, you know, who's ringing the doorbell on a Sunday afternoon? And I open the door. Here's this young woman with a petition. She says, I'm carrying this petition for my brother, who's a lawyer, and he's running to be a Trump delegate to the Republican National Convention. Will you sign it? She had no idea who I was. It turns out she's working the neighborhood. Her brother is working the neighborhood. So, of course, I quickly gave them a book. Anderson Cooper said to me later when I told the story on air, did you sign the petition? I said, yes, I signed the petition. They also had a petition to get his name on the Pennsylvania ballot. And what struck me was it was 19 degrees that day in Harrisburg, wow. Pennsylvania. And these two folks were our brother and sister team. He's a local lawyer. We're out there going house to house to house. And it was freezing cold. That's passion. Yes. You know, that's yes. passion for a candidate. And so it's really an interesting thing to see.
So one of the theories that I said today on the show, and I think is correct, is that if this race stays a four-person race, a really five-person race, I guess, at this point, right, Trump's going to be the nominee. I think he tomorrow night in Nevada, it's going to be huge. And then
huge.
It's going to be tremendous. Tremendous night in Nevada. Right. Tomorrow night, and then we have Super Tuesday, March 1st. So he could really roll through Super Tuesday as well. He's leading in most of the states right
yes.
now, right?
Yes.
But now what happens if say, there was this talk of a meeting between Cruz and Rubio, and what happens if one of them drops out and, say, Kasich drops out, and they all try to pick one person to go mano a mano against Trump?
If Ted Cruz drops out, in truth, I think a lot of Ted Cruz's supporters would go to Donald Trump. Frankly, if this had not worked out for Donald Trump and Ted Cruz were the leader, I think a lot of the Trump people would have gone for Ted Cruz.
Is that because of the outsider thing?
And yes. I mean, I can only tell you the Washington establishment, and you know, I know a lot of these people and they're friends, and I mean, they cannot abide either of these people. I mean, to say, as I think Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina said, that a choice between Donald Trump and Ted Cruz for these people was a question of a choice between getting shot, hung, or taking poison. And I thought, yeah, I can kind of get the deal here. But I'm one of these people that I really think that this is a pro-Trump situation here, and that there are a lot of people that are going to vote for him if one of these others drops out. And it's if you do get a one-on-one situation, I still think at this point that Donald is going to carry the day, because I do, you know, I haven't seen anybody from the Rubio campaign on my doorstep in 19 degrees.
Right.
As I also noted to somebody, I never saw anybody from the Romney campaign in nice weather 4 years ago. So I do think that that means a lot.
You, in your book, which is a great book, by the way, and everybody has a copy, and Jeff is going to sign your copy before the night's over tonight, couple things that I found really interesting. You point out that Trump has gotten things done. In fact, you talk about Woolman Ice Rink in
right.
one of the stories.
Right. The Woolman Ice Rink, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is in Central Park in New York City. And for years, the city of New York, when Mayor Koch was there, Ed Koch, had been trying to get this rink renovated because it was in very bad shape, and they, I guess they couldn't use it. It was a problem, et cetera, et cetera. This went on for years. They spent millions trying to do this and couldn't get it done. And Donald Trump said to the mayor, you know, mayor, let me do this. Well, no, no, because he was not all that much of a Trump fan. You know, he didn't want to do this, et cetera. Finally, I mean, the headlines just got to be unbearable. And he, so he goes to Donald and says, okay, do it. Well, of course, in typical Trump style, he got it done quick. I mean, I forget what the I can't remember off the top of my head how much time it took, but it was well under budget. It was done very well. He did it absolutely professionally. He got people in there who knew how to put together ice skating rinks, and he got it done. And that rink is there to this day in good shape. That is, and when I sort of looked at his career, this is the kind of thing he does repeatedly. One of the other examples that I discovered is that there was a prominent hotel in Manhattan, in the middle of Manhattan, that was just, you know, decrepit and run down. And this is in the 1970s when New York was not doing so well. And he thought, what if I, you know, took over, I guess it was the Commodore Hotel, and if I take this over. And people said, oh, Donald, you know, don't do this. Well, one of the interesting things he did is he went to Grand Central Station and just stood there on one of those upper levels and watched all the people coming and going from Grand Central Station. And he said, you know, there are people here who would use this hotel if it were a good hotel. So he got it done. He you know, either took the thing down or had it renovated. It's a Grand Hyatt. It's one of the best hotels in the middle of Manhattan. And there you go. I mean, he just does not take no for an answer. And on another one of these occasions, they had some, they discovered as they were taking down a building that he had purchased that there were some sculptural things on there from whatever. And then suddenly people said, well, you can't take those off. You know, we think they may be valuable. We think, you know, we're not sure, et cetera. He says, look, we've got a schedule here. We're going to do this. They said, oh, you can't do it. He just went ahead and did it,
right,
which caused all this angst. And there stands this wonderful building to this day. In other words, the mentality is that you get things done. And heaven knows in government, as I can certainly tell you, and I began my Washington career working for Congressman, then Congressman Bud Schuster from the central Pennsylvania Altoona area. And then I worked for those of you who remember, the late Senator John Hines as his executive assistant. And then into the White House, and then the last part for Jack Kemp at HUD. Government is designed to tell 1,000 reasons why you can't do something. And you've got all these people and all these special interests pushing against one another, and it becomes almost impossible to do anything. And this is not his mentality. So I think that at this point, when you see all the problems we have, you know, Social Security careening out of control and Medicare, and I mean all these things that are not working and looming, and you get the people that run these, they're on the trust boards of these groups, and they say, well, you know, we're going to run out of money and such and such. Not to mention the debt. The debt is the thing that boggles my mind. We're almost $20 trillion in debt. When you think of all the problems from the sort of great crash, as it were, of 2008, which was caused by government, which Hillary Clinton never seems to quite catch up with the fact that an investigation into this shows that Bill Clinton's insistence on changing the regulations so that banks were, in essence, forced to give mortgages to people who couldn't afford them. Government plays a large role in these things, and the answer is that you know, we just can't keep doing this, or the whole economy will crash. Everybody's health care, their savings accounts, all of this.
Right.
If suddenly we are in default of you know, $20 or $24 billion, and he keeps saying, he said to me, you know, if we get to like $24 trillion, we're in real trouble because we're not going to be able to pay it back. And then what do you do? And what you do is basically the Great Depression, and I don't think any of us want to go there.
No, I don't think so either. Anybody want that? I don't. Probably not, right? We're not into that. Well, although Bernie could give it all to us for free. So
yeah,
you know,
that's right. That.
That
is correct.
There is that. And I believe him when he says it. So that part was a joke. Now, let's talk about numbers for a second here. South Carolina primary, which obviously Donald Trump won in big numbers. I played the clip on my show today, Jeff, of Marco Rubio pointing out, as I've pointed out too, and a lot of people have pointed out, 67, give or take, percent of the voters did not pick the winner of the South Carolina primary. So, you know, for people that are not Trump supporters, they point to that number and they say, you see, more voters rejected him than voted for him.
The shorthand for this is the silver and gold medals, silver and bronze medals are really the gold medal, and just ignore the rest of it.
Right.
It doesn't work that way. You know, you actually have to win. As Bernie Sanders is finding out, if you want to beat Hillary Clinton, you have to beat her. And he's managed to do the came close in Iowa, and he almost did it in New Hampshire. But now he's got to do it in these other places as well. I mean, ever thus. So if somebody wants to beat Donald Trump, they actually have to do it. And, you know, I mean, the polls are not great for those who think that they are going to do it, but we certainly will see. And just my educated political guess is that if he plows through these Super Tuesday primaries, it then becomes, you know, momentum is one of these factors that plays a big role in
the
this.
Big Mo.
The Big Mo. The Big Mo. As Barbara Bush said the other day when remembering the 1980 race between President Bush 41 and Ronald Reagan, when George H.W. Bush won the Iowa caucuses, he was on the cover, I think, of Newsweek, and it had him in his jogging suit, and he's running, and it says, you know, Bush gets the Big Mo, and Barbara Bush the other day said, you know, he got the Big Mo, and it was no Mo after that. So, you know, I think Donald Trump has the Big Mo here, and I think he's going to be able to keep it going.
That was also a West Wing quote, too, the Big Mo. I think they talked about that in one of the West Wing episodes.
You know, for those of you, I mean, having worked in the White House, I mean, I enjoyed the West Wing, or as some of my conservative friends called it, the Left Wing.
The Left Wing, yeah.
but if you saw all this business where they're walking around, this doesn't exist. This is a Hollywood set. The West Wing, in reality, is fairly small, and it's very traditional. I mean, this was built in 1903 by Teddy Roosevelt. And so this business where Rob Lowe and these other guys are going endlessly and there's these glass-paneled corridors, I'm thinking, what in God's name were they thinking? This isn't even remotely close to the West Wing.
We have some questions from the audience, Jeff.
All right.
As a political outsider, will Donald Trump become frustrated with the intricacies of the government, i.e. getting legislation passed? Because you talked about earlier
right. How,
you know, the bureaucracy exists to give you 1,000 reasons why it can't work.
Right. I've always been sort of amused at there's two criticisms that seem to go in tandem of Donald Trump. One is that he's an authoritarian, and the other that he's a deal maker. You know, most authoritarians I've heard of are not deal makers. He is a deal maker. Yeah, famously, as he said, second to the Bible, his favorite book is The Art of the Deal, which he wrote. there is nothing wrong with making deals. Ronald Reagan made deals all of the time. The question is, what direction do you take the country when you make the deal? Margaret Thatcher used to have this saying that she applied to British politics, which is certainly applicable here to American politics. And she would accuse her Tory colleagues in the British Conservative Party of being pushing the what she called the socialist ratchet. And she defined it this way, that a Labour government would come in Britain and move the country left. Then eventually they'd run out of political steam and a Conservative government would be elected. And they'd just basically sit there. Mm-hmm. And eventually they'd run out of steam. And then a Labour government would come in and then they'd move the country again left. And so the net effect was that you kept ratcheting. The socialist ratchet would keep moving Britain leftward till by the time she got to be prime minister, the country was a basket case. I would suggest that that's been part of the Republican Party's problem here in America, with the exception of Ronald Reagan, who was, of course, Margaret Thatcher's political soulmate. But we have people, and I pick on poor President Bush, 43, whom I like. I've met. I mean, he's a terrific guy. But no child left behind. You know, Ronald Reagan wanted to abolish the Department of Education, which was created by Jimmy Carter, because he knew that this would just grow like Topsy.
and that, you know, you'd, more and more money would come into this, and then you'd hire more lobbyists, and, you know, the city just, I mean, it's just bizarre how this works. And President Bush, 43, with his quote-unquote compassionate conservatism, basically comes up with No Child Left Behind. Well, today, this is, you know, a multi-zillion dollar part of the Department of Education,
right.
And I mean, it's all this sort of stuff. And the thing that you always have to recognize is, I mean, Margaret Thatcher was right. I mean, eventually George W. leaves office to be succeeded by Barack Obama, right? And Barack Obama thinks, oh, this is great. Let's, you know, slog that money in there. This is the way, this is the problem with the government, is that we think everything is needs a government solution. Everything. I mean, this is Bernie Sanders' take on life, right? And the money is all going to come from you. And as Margaret Thatcher used to say, sooner or later, you run out of other people's money, and that is, of course, what happens.
Right. So on that note, Trump has gotten a lot of criticism.
So he can deal. In other words, he can negotiate.
He can deal.
He can deal. I mean, but the question is, when he makes the deal, which way will he take the country? And I think he's pretty well set on that.
One of the things that I like that he said is that he doesn't want to show his hand. He doesn't want to show his cards.
Right.
Because when you're negotiating, you don't want to walk into a room and let everybody know how you feel right away. But, you know, he's been criticized a lot in the last couple days for saying that he doesn't want people dying in the streets. Rush, even the other day, was going on about how people don't die in the streets in America. And couldn't he be accused of trying to reinvigorate compassionate conservatism by suggesting that, you know, healthcare's got to make sure people don't die in the streets?
Well, he said, you know, and one of the interesting things is he mentioned the word, the dreaded word, mandate.
Yes.
The other night when he was talking to Anderson Cooper.
Not in the smirconish way. This was more of in the... that was it. Nobody got that? Come on, people. Just kidding. All right. No, in the sense of mandate, and he agrees with the mandate for Obamacare.
Right. And I saw him the next morning on CNN, and he said, I think it was CNN, maybe it was Fox. Oh, my God, I was watching Fox. What was I thinking? He said, you know, Anderson and I were talking over one another, and he said, I'm not blaming Anderson, but I'm not talking about a mandate. And then he clarified and went back. And, you know, he's talking about health savings accounts. He's talking, I mean, one of the things that really gets to him, which I certainly had thought was important. I mean, here's a guy with businesses, just to pick two locations. He has businesses in New York, and he has businesses in California. And, of course, he has health insurance for his employees. Well, he couldn't, you know, get the best plan, right? He's got to buy the New York insurance in New York, and he's got to buy the California insurance in California. And he said, why are we doing this? He says, and I'll tell you why we're doing this. We're doing this because the insurance company lobbyists have got their politicians all set in Washington to support this, and meanwhile, your prices go up.
Yep.
So it's, I mean, he's needless to say, he is very free market oriented. So I think he's going to be fine on these kind of things.
You know, one of the things that I love about Trump is that he never apologizes. I mean, he says some politically incorrect stuff. Have you noticed?
Wait, is that true?
Have you guys heard that? I don't know. It might be a rumor.
Wow.
But he never apologizes.
No.
And, you know, I think we've all had it with the political correctness of always feeling like we're walking on eggshells and, you know, you can't make a joke, you can't offend somebody, can't hurt somebody, everybody needs a safe space. He's really the embodiment of all that coming into fruition of people that have just said, you know, I've had it. If you can't deal with it, that's on you, not
right.
on me.
One of the things, and I talk about this in some length in the book, is, you know, political correctness started out, a couple decades ago, and it was, mildly amusing, mildly irritating, depending on your point of view. And over time, this has gotten to be really serious. And I'll just a few examples here. There was a woman quoted on the front page of the Washington Post. They were interviewing Trump supporters at a rally in Tampa, Florida. And this woman was retired. She was 63. She had spent her career as an administrator at a college in Ohio. And she said that when she finally left, she said, you were not allowed to say Merry Christmas. You were not allowed to use the words his or him or her because this would offend the transgender community. Seriously, she said this. And she ran through this list of things. Now, when you think how ridiculous this is, but then you get to
Major Nadal Hassan, whom we all remember at Fort Hood. And here he is, a major in the United States Army, and he shows up at his post at Fort Hood, Texas. And he goes into this room filled with people, filled with soldiers and civilians, sits down, bows his head, stands up, says, Allahu Akbar, pulls out a gun, kills 13 people, 12 of whom were uniformed soldiers, wounds all these other people. He's finally shot, paralyzed by one of the soldiers. And we find out afterwards that the Army knew that he had this problem, that he was very much into jihad, that the FBI or whatever had been watching him, and they didn't want to do anything because of political correctness. And then you go to San Bernardino when we find out that the neighbors thought there was something up with these people, and they didn't want to say anything because of political correctness. And then, of course, you get to the President of the United States, who doesn't want to say the words radical Islam when we have this fairly serious problem going on in the world. We reached a point where this has gone from a minor annoyance or amusement to being lethal.
Right.
People are dead. American citizens are dead on American soil because of this. And, you know, at some point, when do you say, enough, enough is enough? And I think one of the reasons, you know, most presidential elections, and it's true in this case as well, you focus on the economy, you focus on national security, foreign policy issues. But I really think in this presidential election, political correctness has become a huge issue. And people have had it. And they've experienced it as this one woman did in Ohio in their own individual personal lives. And they see it rampant, running rampant through society. And then when you get to the military and government and all of this, this is just out of control.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a great answer, Jeff. So another question from the audience tonight. Great questions, everybody. Thank you for this. This is a big one. Now, how does Trump prevent the Republican Party from a brokered convention where they put someone else in?
I think the people in this room would not allow it, to be perfectly candid. I mean, there's people like you all over the country. And I think if they did do it, whoever they nominated would go down in flames. I mean, just the backlash would be tremendous.
I mean, what they did to Ron Paul a few years ago at the convention.
Right,
you know,
right.
And that was a revolt. You imagine what they would try that?
Right, right. I mean, they have no business doing this. Yeah. And the thing that just gets to me is that they think they have the business to do it. And I just think at this point, particularly in this year, that the American public and the grassroots of the Republican Party and the conservative base, however you want to phrase it, is simply not going to stand for it. And there would be hell to pay.
You know, it's interesting because Reince Priebus, who's the head of the Republican National Committee, we played the quote on the show today, said that he'll support whoever the nominee is, and, you know, that's the way it's going to be, which is a good answer from the Republican National Committee chairman. But a lot of people are also suggesting that, hey, you know, Trump could still decide to go third party. He tweeted out something today saying that Ted Cruz should drop out of the race, but he doesn't expect the Republican Party to do anything about it. Would it be in his best interest in any way, shape, or form to go third party?
I don't think so, to be perfectly candid. I think, you know, what he does, let's go back to the art of the deal. You know, he knows how to negotiate here.
Right.
And I think a lot of his opponents have sort of missed this, that what he is, the way he conducts himself and when he does these things, that's part of the negotiation process. And, you know, he got to the point of that pledge, and then he signed the pledge. Well, then, of course, you had people popping up later on the Republican side, you know, some of the candidates, well, you know, I'm not sure that I could support Donald Trump and all this. Well, then, hello,
right,
who's
right.
breaking the pledge here? I don't really think he would do that. I mean, he's very competitive, and I think he wants to win, and I think he is winning.
Well, on that note, an audience member asks, I'm very frustrated, even though I support Trump. How is he going to accomplish his statements?
One of the things that I think goes on here is that we've had political people running the government. Nothing surprising about that. So that their understanding of how to do things, I mean, think of the Woolman Rink again, just as a sort of simple example. They've never done this kind of thing. They don't know how to do it. So when he says, I will build a wall and Mexico will pay for it, he's approaching this with a builder's mindset. He's not approaching it from a politician's mindset. What he's communicating, and I think a lot of people don't hear it, is I literally know how to do this. If you've ever been in Trump Tower, I mean, it's quite a place, you know, which he built from the ground up. Now, if you can build Trump Tower, not to mention all these other places all the way around the world, you certainly can build a wall along the Mexican border. And I just think that we are filled with a political class that doesn't understand, literally, how to do these things. Everything is politics to them.
Right.
Everything. One of the things that he talks about often enough is trade. And he's a free trader. But he believes that we've had people who don't know what they're doing negotiating the trade deals. And I took a look at the kind of people that had been appointed U.S. trade ambassador. And the one that, I mean, and he was fairly typical of the breed, so that's why I'm using his name. He was President Obama's first trade ambassador. His name was Ron Kirk. And what were Ron Kirk's qualifications to be the U.S. trade ambassador? He'd been the mayor of Dallas. He's a Democrat. He ran for the United States Senate as a Democrat in Texas and lost. And he was a lobbyist. Well, of course you make this man your trade representative to deal with the Chinese and, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Another one that Donald talks about, and we all know her, and certainly as a big JFK fan in my youth, you know, you have this perpetual image of Caroline Kennedy as the little five-year-old daughter there in 1963. And I think Ivanka Trump is actually friends with Caroline Kennedy. But Donald Trump says, you know, she's a lovely person. But why is she the ambassador to Japan negotiating trade deals with the Japanese?
Right.
That, again, is the political mentality here. And I think that's one of the reasons why people are listening to him, because he's saying, in essence, we've got the wrong people doing these jobs, and therefore we wind up with the wrong results. If you saw that, did anybody see this Carrier air conditioning video the other day? For those of you who didn't, Carrier Air Conditioning, which is a subsidiary of United Technologies, has an Indiana plant where they make air conditioning. And they gathered their employees together to tell them, and somebody, you know, in this day and age had the cell phone and held it up. And here are these, 1,400 people in the middle of Indiana getting the pink slip. And they're being told, literally, we're moving your plant to Mexico, and you are all out of a job. Well, who negotiates this kind of thing? I mean, that's his point. Not that we shouldn't have free trade. Of course, we should have free trade, but there has to be. I mean, I can hear my old boss John Hines talk about this at length. He from the heir to the Hines ketchup fortune and from Pittsburgh with the steel companies and all this, and he would say some version of this exact same thing. And as Pennsylvanians, we are, you know, sensitive to this. I mean, this is a big part of our economy. So
who would you see as Trump's running mate and why?
Good question. Historically speaking, when you think, for instance, of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, or to go back even further, John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, there were only seven primaries in 1960. So LBJ never ran in one, but he had managed as Senate Majority Leader to get a lot of delegates with the help of his Senate friends, and it was he who was the main challenger to JFK at the Democratic Convention. And Reagan wound up picking Bush, who came in second to him, and Kennedy wound up picking Johnson. And the reason you do that is, of course, that these people have been through the fire, and it's clear that even though they're number two, they are number two, and they do have a substantial base of support. So there's always this belief among some that you should look to that person and get that person, and so you have sort of a unity ticket. Then there's a school of thought that you should just pick somebody else entirely, maybe somebody who didn't run for president. I mean, I personally think it helps if they did run for president because, you know, their name is out there and they've already been through the fire and all of this kind of thing. So if he does that, I mean, it could be, you know, Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio, and I've written two columns suggesting Ted Cruz. It could be Marco Rubio. It could be Carly Fiorina. It could be Governor Kasich. I mean, it could be any one of these people. You also want to think as somebody who did work for Ronald Reagan, George Bush was a representative. George Bush Sr. was a representative of the moderate wing of the Republican Party. And my friend Ed Rollins, who was a White House political director and later ran the Reagan reelection campaign in 1984 that carried 49 states, said that he felt when he first heard that Reagan had picked Bush that the conservative wing of the party had won and then immediately surrendered its sword in terms of the future, and that we had, quote-unquote, in Ed's phrase, cut the fuse on the Reagan revolution. And his point was that he was concerned that if you looked down the road to who would succeed Reagan, that you know the party might drift back to its moderate ways. Well, in point of fact, that more or less is what happened.
Yeah.
And George H.W. Bush ran as Reagan's third term. He got elected in gangbuster style in another landslide, and then immediately started to govern as a moderate Republican. And 4 years later, you know, he gets 37% of the vote and loses. And then we nominated Bob Dole, and then we nominated, you know, George W. and compassionate conservatism and all this kind of thing. So you want to make sure if you pick somebody, when you pick somebody, that you pick somebody that can carry the conservative ball if, God forbid, anything happens, or if you serve out your term and you're so popular, as Reagan was, that you've got somebody there that carries on the legacy and doesn't try, in essence, to repeal it.
So on that note, what are the parallels you see between Trump and Ronald Reagan, President Reagan?
Well, number one, and I don't think people seem to get this, the political professionals. Donald Trump, like Ronald Reagan and like Arnold Schwarzenegger, and I'm not talking about political ideology here, but all three of them were and are cultural figures. And, you know, Ronald Reagan, in my youth, was, you know, and long before I was around, was a famous movie actor from starting in the 1930s. And then he became the host of GE Theater, and he was a presence in television in everybody's living room on Sunday nights at 8 or 9 o'clock as the host and sometimes the star of GE Theater. And I think he even did Death Valley Days in there for a stint. By the time he ran for governor of California, everybody in California, everybody in America knew who he was. Ditto Arnold. I mean, we all will be back and all the movies and all of this sort of thing. And I saw just today where somebody was saying that they thought that the Trump campaign bore some similarities to Arnold's election as governor in that recall in California. But when you are that much of a cultural figure and you're dealing with your opponents are all politicians, I mean, let's face it, unless you were really following politics closely, you probably may not have known who Marco Rubio was or who Ted Cruz is or the governor of Ohio or whatever. So as they present themselves in this contest, they're all pals, and they're running these ads saying, well, Donald Trump this and Donald Trump that. Meanwhile, everybody in America knows, oh, I know Donald Trump. I know what he's like. I watched The Apprentice. Right. Kind of thing. And it makes them somewhat, I think, impervious to this kind of stuff, that they're calling him the Teflon Don. I think there is a reason for it, is that in the public psyche, people know exactly who he is. They've seen him in all of his exploits, good, bad, and indifferent, for, 30, 40 years, whatever it is, and you're not going to change their impression of him now with a few commercials.
Another question from the audience here. How's Mr. Trump going to win the African-American vote?
This very day, I had sent to me by a prominent Democrat, whom I will not name, news that Donald Trump had been endorsed in Tennessee by an African-American either newspaper or online website that apparently is very prominent. They had endorsed on the Democratic side Hillary Clinton, and on the Republican side, they endorsed Donald Trump. Well, I read the endorsement, and it was really quite remarkable. Basically, they said, we are so tired of being taken for granted. And, every 4 years, we're the butt of the joke, that we're always supporting the latest Democrat at the moment. And then they use the phrase, and then we get flushed down the toilet, quote unquote. And they said that they liked Donald Trump because, A, he knew how to create jobs. And if there's one thing the African-American community needs, it's jobs. Two, they liked his blunt spokenness. And they liked the fact that he goes after ISIS. And they were going through chapter and verse about not African-Americans, but Africans
who were having their heads chopped off by ISIS. And they said, where are people on the Democratic side? Where are all these Republican establishment politicians? I mean, Donald Trump is the only one talking about this. I think because he is exactly a unique kind of soul here, that he can go into places in the African-American community and ditto the Hispanic community and make real inroads in a way that none of these other candidates can do.
How about with women voters? Would it be wise? Let me ask you this, Jeff. Would it be wise for Trump to consider having a woman on the ticket?
Sure, sure. I mean, I would have to believe that Carly Fiorina's name would be on that list.
Is that bad to have? And I'm not suggesting it is, but I'll ask the question: is it bad, you think, to have two people without government experience on the ticket?
And that might be a drawback. There's Governor Susana Martinez out there in New Mexico. There's always Sarah Palin. who I think wants to be Secretary of Energy
Nikki Haley, even though she backed Rubio.
Nikki Haley, exactly. So all of this, to be perfectly candid, I mean, all of this is considered in the cold light of the calculus of how can I win?
That's
what everybody does here. I mean, there was a reason for Joe Biden's presence on that ticket with Barack Obama, and it was to be the senior guy, the guy with the gray hair who'd been around.
Yep.
And to get people relaxed about the idea of having a young senator from Illinois as president. It worked.
Yeah, and if Hillary's the nominee, in other words, if she's not in jail or indicted, which we all pray for.
And that actually
pray for,
is, an interesting thought.
It is an interesting thought.
I mean, I keep talking to people down there, and the turmoil, as I understand it, inside the FBI is considerable. Mm-hmm. Because there is apparently a feeling that she really is in trouble here. And, of course, this has to go to the Department of Justice, and the feeling is that no matter what happens, if on the one hand they recommend indicting her, there would be hell to pay.
Right.
On the other hand, if they recommend not indicting her, there would be hell to pay within the FBI. And I've heard on more than one occasion parallels drawn to, for those of us who remember Watergate and the Saturday night massacre in which Richard Nixon fired the special prosecutor who was investigating him for Watergate on a Saturday. And by the end of the day, by that night, Elliot Richardson, who was he wanted him fired. I mean, he told, because he was under the purview of the Attorney General, he directed Attorney General Richardson to fire him, and Richardson refused and said, I'll resign before I do it, and handed in his resignation. So too did William Ruckelshaus, who was the number two guy. Well, this was screaming headlines. Finally, Robert Bork, whom we all think of as a Supreme Court nominee, he was the number three guy. He was the Solicitor General, and he said, well, the president of the United States has given a direct order here. Somebody has to be here in the building to do it, so they fired him. But the uproar was tremendous and so incredible that Nixon was forced to appoint a new one. And, of course, we all know how that ended. So the feeling is that James Comey is exactly like Elliot Richardson in that sense, that he is such a strict by-the-book guy that if he feels there's any funny business here, that he will head south. But we will see.
It's interesting that Joe Biden is getting all this attention lately still, right?
I'm still here, he said.
Yeah, I'm still here, and it's not too late. It really won't be too late until the convention to put him in. So.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, everybody feels terrible for him. I mean, he had this terrible situation with his son, and we can all understand the emotional impact, and how do you pick up sticks and get on with your life and run for president, which is a pretty demanding thing. But most assuredly, if something happened along the indictment lines with Hillary Clinton, they would be forced, I think, if not to Bernie Sanders, but to somebody like Joe Biden or John Kerry, who's got the reputation, the name, and they've been around.
There's a lot of groans, of grumbles and groans
exactly.
in the audience.
Exactly.
Not big John Kerry people, are you, huh? Shocking.
Do you remember when John Kerry came to Philadelphia and he went to get, what was it?
Pats or Geno's?
Pats or Geno's, and he asked for, what was it? What did he ask for? Swiss cheese. Now, I've been to both Pat and Geno's, and I'm thinking, what in God's name are you thinking here?
I think it was Swiss cheese with lettuce and tomato, too.
And, the thing that really got me is he's married to Teresa Hines, right? my late boss's wife, and I thought, well, geez, Teresa, didn't you have the, you know, you should have just said to him, John, be straight here when you
right,
do this.
Right. Now, as Trump would have, if he had ordered Swiss cheese and they called him out on it, he would have said, all the other cheeses are loser cheese. So
right.
your sandwich
right.
is the problem, not
right,
me.
Right.
Change your sandwich. And that's, you know.
Always attack.
Right, always attack. Yeah, yeah. Now it's tremendous.
Don't play
with Swiss
defense.
Cheese, it's tremendous.
Right, right.
With provolone, it was stupid. Wiz,
amazing.
What is Wiz? What
amazing.
Is Wiz?
Huge.
Oh, we know you got to get back to Harrisburg. You're going to be on CNN tomorrow night, right?
I will be on from the Harrisburg studio tomorrow night and then off to Houston, Texas.
Very
on,
cool.
On Wednesday, and I think I'm supposed to be on with Anderson from Houston Wednesday night and then Thursday and... You know, another one of these debates. You know, the debate numbers on that stage keep getting smaller,
yes,
and, smaller and smaller and smaller. And guess who's still there?
So tomorrow night we'll watch for you in the Nevada Cup. We're all going to watch CNN tomorrow night. We're going to make an exception because I know you're a lot of Fox News fans. But we want to see Jeff tomorrow night and we'll analyze Nevada. I predict a huge win by Trump in Nevada. Fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. The only thing that always throws me off is these caucus states. I mean, you know, these
True.
Things are intricate and sort of strange, and God bless him, American democracy at its finest or unfinest.
Yeah.
So we will see. But, yeah, he's expected to do well.
We have our own debate watch party Thursday night at Chickies and Pete's in South Philly. I won't be there, but Chris and Dom will be there, and we'd love to see you guys there and come by and say hello. And then, you know, Super Tuesday is March 1st.
So. Correct. Correct.
Well, now, let me ask you this question, too, before we let you go. With all of your power and influence, Jeff Lord, you can't move the Pennsylvania primary up 30 days so we could really
what
matter.
What are these
Come
people
on.
Doing? I mean, I don't understand for the life of us why we have not moved to March to be part of the Super Tuesday crowd.
Yeah.
I mean, hey, folks, this is Pennsylvania. We're a big urban and rural industrial state. I mean, the notion... that we are playing no role in this. So by the time, what is our primary, April 26th, by the time we all get in there, this is over one way or
right,
another.
Right.
I never can understand what we're doing here with this.
No, and what did James Carville say about Pennsylvania, right?
Yes, he said that there's Philadelphia, there's Pittsburgh, and in between is Alabama, and that's where I live.
But he meant in terms of how they vote, though, right?
Yeah,
he wasn't trying
to. Yeah, thank you, James.
Right. But no, I mean, I do think that if Trump is the nominee, Pennsylvania will be in play without question.
Absolutely.
And I think
will.
New York and New Jersey will be in play just because his name ID is so high and, you know.
And again, this, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I heard from Republican establishment folks when I was young and first involved in 1976 that said, Ronald Reagan could not possibly carry Pennsylvania, and therefore we had to nominate Gerald Ford because only moderate Republicans can win in Pennsylvania. And so we got Gerald Ford, and he promptly proceeded to lose Pennsylvania. And 4 years later, Ronald Reagan ran and carried Pennsylvania, and he carried New York, and he carried Massachusetts, and he carried New Jersey. I mean, on and on. So, yes, this definitely is doable.
Reagan Democrats have become Trump Democrats.
That's correct. And I've written a piece on this because
I know. I was citing your piece, American Spectator.
Exactly. Thank you. Well, he did a rally. Donald Trump did a rally in a place called Birch Run, Michigan, which is near Flint. And it's a Democratic area represented by a Democrat in Congress. The turnout was huge. And one of my fellow CNN colleagues, Amanda Carpenter, who is a former Cruz staff person and is for Ted Cruz, is from that area. And she said that area is filled with union folks, auto union folks. Mm-hmm. And she said either they're working or they're out of a job or what have you. She says the fact that they're all there and they're cheering Donald Trump should scare every Democrat
right,
out there.
Right, exactly.
So,
well, listen, I want to thank Jeff Lord. What a great conversation.
Thank
right?
you. Thank you for having me.
And we're going to sign some books. Before we do, I just want to see that pretty lady in the back is Dawn Stenslin. You hear her on my show every day. She does a tremendous job. And let's sign some books. What
All
do you
right,
say?
Let's do it.
All right, great.